Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Anna Mateo, and Susan Shand. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. International students can face many kinds of barriers in applying for admission to colleges and universities in the United States. These can include high costs and extreme distance from family and friends. A difficulty most students from non-English-speaking countries face in the U.S. is a language barrier. Many such students feel they have little or no chance of gaining admission to an American school because of their poor English skills. But what if that barrier was removed from the application process?
Rob Hardin says this is the goal of a special path to American higher education called conditional admission. Hardin is the Assistant Director for International Student Recruitment at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. He says most colleges and universities in the U.S. want international students on their campuses. It adds significant value to have a student from Beijing, a student from Hanoi, a student from London in the classroom with the student from Portland, Oregon, Hardin told VOA. We think that enhances the student from Portland, Oregon's experience. He adds that many U.S. schools now accept the fact that some of the best students in the world do not speak perfect English. So, over the last 10 years, more and more schools have begun using conditional admission as a way of helping these students.
The way it works at the University of Oregon is very simple, Hardin says. International students apply in the same way any other student would. They provide records of their grades, information about their activities outside of school, and other application materials. They also must provide proof of their scores on an English language ability test, such as the TOEFL. Hardin notes that many American colleges and universities only accept applicants whose TOEFL score reaches a certain level. But conditional admission permits students to ask for special consideration. Those schools then look at all the other materials these applicants have provided. Then the schools decide whether an applicant would be a good fit with some more English education. If the University of Oregon approves a student for conditional admission, he or she is placed in a special English language education program, Hardin says. First, the university tests the students to identify which of seven instructional levels they should enter. Then they begin English classes taught by university professors. Hardin says many international students prefer to study English in their native countries. It is usually more economical, for one, and it means less time away from their homes and families.
At the University of Oregon, conditional admission students may start their degree program as soon as they complete the highest level of the language program. Hardin says this is true of most schools that offer conditional admission. He also argues that these conditional admissions programs offer more than a traditional language school can. He says they help international students get used to the American college experience before they start their degree program. Also, students often grow their language skills much faster while living at an American college and using its resources. You're going to have to figure out how to go to the grocery store and buy apples, said Hardin. You're going to take what you're learning in the classroom and you're going to be able to immediately apply it to your daily life. Hardin adds that this kind of non-traditional path to admission is not just for students with extremely weak English language skills. He says even generally strong non-native speakers can lack the level of English skill needed for success at an American college.
For students whose TOEFL scores are still not high enough for traditional admission, some schools offer what is called a bridge program. At the University of Oregon, students in the bridge program must take as many as 6 special English classes in addition to the ones for their degree program. Again, students take a test at the start of their studies to determine how many of the bridge program classes they need. The classes are meant to provide a little extra language support, and they often relate to the general subject classes students are already taking. At the University of Oregon, Hardin adds, international students must complete their bridge program classes within their first year. Hardin says that both bridge programs and conditional admission are designed to make American higher education more inclusive. And they provide a path for students that they otherwise might not have known was available to them.
But he also notes that international students should not expect every college and university in the U.S. to offer such programs. This is especially true of the top schools that get the most attention worldwide. At those institutions, competition is fierce, and students who are already strong in English have a better chance at acceptance. Places that receive such a high number of applications want to admit students who are frequently going to have perfect grades, perfect SAT scores, Hardin said. And I don't think they're interested in teaching English. It's not really what they've ever done. And a lot of these institutions do not have a shortage of applications. So, he adds, a student who is worried about their language abilities may want to consider one of the hundreds of lesser-known schools. Asking one of those schools if they offer conditional admission or a bridge program might be what makes their dreams of American higher education come true. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Beans are a popular food in many countries. From black to red, from kidney to pinto, beans are important in the diet of many cultures. Rich in fiber, protein, and nutrients, beans are a healthy, plant-based food. So, spilling the beans at home or in a store would not be good. Food is important and does not belong on the floor. Spilling the beans when you communicate with others is also a bad thing. When you spill the beans, you share or make public secret information. You don't mean to do it. The secrets just spill out of you. However, this expression does not come from cooking beans or the fact that we shouldn't waste food. The expression spill the beans has been a part of the English language for hundreds of years. Some word historians say the term was first used all the way back in the 1500s. If you think that sounds old, you may be surprised to learn that the origin of spill the beans goes back to ancient Greece. Several websites say this expression comes from one way ancient Greeks voted. Back then, in some communities, people voted by dropping a white or black bean into a clay urn. If the container fell on its side or broke, the beans would spill out. And this would show everyone the results of the secret vote before all the beans were counted. While this origin story is interesting, it does not explain why the term spill the beans does not appear in common usage until much later. Maybe it is because other expressions with the same meaning were simply more popular. For example, letting the cat out of the bag means the same as spilling the beans. We've explained the meaning of to let the cat out of the bag before, but it's always good to hear it again. Americans use the verb spill in much the same way. Sometimes we simply say spill it. When you tell others to spill it, you are asking them to tell you all the details about something immediately. This term is very casual and could even sound offensive depending on the situation and expression in your voice. So it's best to use it with close friends, family, or when you are joking around. Blab is another word meaning to spill the beans. Blab is not the nicest word, however. A man who blabbers keeps talking and talking as if he can't keep his mouth closed. A blabbermouth is someone who can't keep their mouth shut. Blabbermouths are known for often spilling the beans and for letting more than a few cats out of the bag. From among our expressions today, spill the beans, let the cat out of the bag, and blabber, the blabbermouth does not always mean someone who gives away secrets. They sometimes just talk too much. Well, I don't want to be accused of being a blabbermouth, so this will be the end of this Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. I'm Ana Mateo. Don't start me talking.
Myanmar's business leaders are supporting Aung San Suu Kyi's plan to resettle Rohingya refugees and to rebuild Rakhine State. Last August, Rohingya militant attacks on the police caused a military response that sent more than 650,000 Rohingya fleeing into Bangladesh. Myanmar and Bangladesh have since agreed on a plan to send refugees from Myanmar back to the country within the next 2 years. And the leader of Myanmar is looking for private investment to rebuild Rakhine State. However, the return of refugees has stopped. Rohingya leaders have demanded that community land be returned and human rights violations be investigated. They also want the opportunity to become citizens of Myanmar. In an emailed statement to VOA, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said, "Conditions in Rakhine State are not yet fully conducive to the safe return of refugees." Myanmar's civilian government, led by Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, is constitutionally prevented from questioning the army. It has, however, tried to take control in other ways. The heads of Eden, KBZ, and Asia World were once under Western sanctions because of their ties to the previous government, a military junta. During her years of house arrest, Aung San Suu Kyi criticized them as military cronies. In an October 2016 event, she reminded them of past misdeeds, but asked for those who have previously worked for their own self-interest work for others in the future. The same business leaders who made millions of dollars during military rule now support the Union Enterprise for Humanitarian Assistance, Resettlement, and Development in Rakhine, or UEHRD. It was formed in October with a $13.5 million donation from business leaders. Nu Miet is a senior managing director of KBZ Group. He told VOA some of the $2.2 million donated from his company would be spent on a new fence across the border with Bangladesh. He said this would benefit both countries by stopping illegal migration. Other support has been more direct. Cheet Kai, the Eden Group chairman, told VOA over the phone that his company is building structures in Nakuya, one of two areas near the border where refugees will be returned. The Eden Group built large parts of Myanmar's new capital city in Naypyidaw under military rule. Gerard McCarthy works at the Myanmar Research Center of the Australian National University. He told VOA that asking for the support of businesses for national causes is not a change from NLD values, which believe that capitalists can be moral as long as they contribute. Aung San Suu Kyi's plan also presents Rakhine State as a promising opportunity for increased investment in one of Myanmar's poorest states. The government in October restarted an economic zone in Mangdaw in northern Rakhine State by signing a deal with a group of local and Yangon-based firms. Vicky Bowman, director of the Myanmar Center for Responsible Business, told VOA via email that while humanitarian needs should come first, there was a need for public investment in infrastructure to fight poverty in Rakhine State. However, there are risks. Bowman said that there could be local anger that businesses from outside of Rakhine have more opportunity at a time of strong Rakhine nationalism. I'm Susan Shand.
Our National Parks journey this week takes us to the middle of the Pacific Ocean and America's 50th state. We are exploring the unique and fiery world that is Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Most people would say that the tallest mountain on Earth is Mount Everest, near the border between Nepal and Tibet. But there exists a mountain that is 300 meters taller than Mount Everest. Most of it is underwater, however. It begins at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean and rises more than 17 kilometers from the ocean floor. Its name is Mauna Loa. In the Hawaiian language, Mauna Loa means long mountain. Mauna Loa makes up more than half of the island of Hawaii, one of the 8 major Hawaiian islands. Mauna Loa is the largest volcano on Earth. It last burst in 1984. Today, Mauna Loa is quiet, but volcano experts say it is only a matter of time before it bursts again.
Mauna Loa is one of 2 volcanoes within Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. The other is Kilauea. It is the most active volcano in the world. Red-hot liquid rock, or lava, has continuously flowed from Kilauea since 1983. Most of the time, the lava appears to move peacefully toward the ocean. But it is not as peaceful as it seems from a distance. In 2014, the lava flowed through one small town on the island. It slowly covered the town, blocking and destroying roads. Nothing can stop the lava of Kilauea. When the lava reaches the ocean, its fierce heat produces steam. The lava is so hot that it continues to burn underwater. It cools and hardens over time, creating new land. This volcanic action is what formed and continues to form the Hawaiian Islands.
That volcanic action is one of many unusual features at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. The park's volcanic landscape is almost otherworldly. In fact, NASA uses the top of Mauna Loa to simulate life on Mars for researchers. The national park has 7 ecological areas, including woodlands, rainforests, and even snowy climates. It is home to many native plants and animals. Many endangered species live within the park, such as the hawksbill turtle, the Hawaiian hawk, and Hawaiian goose, or Nene. Evidence of Hawaii's native culture is preserved at the park. The park includes remains of the homes and other structures used by the ancient people of the islands. There are also thousands of petroglyphs created thousands of years ago. Petroglyphs are images carved into rock. The images help explain the living conditions and traditions of the ancient Hawaiians. Hawaiian legend places Mauna Loa at the center of the spiritual world. Pele is the goddess of the volcano. In one traditional story, Pele tries to win the love and attention of the husband of her sister, the sea goddess. Her sister becomes very angry, making powerful ocean waves and floods. Pele seeks a safe place to avoid the punishment. She finally arrives at Mauna Loa. It is so tall that the water cannot threaten her. The volcano goddess makes Mauna Loa her home. The U.S. National Park Service works to protect these natural landscapes important to today's Hawaiians and to their ancestors.
More than 1.5 million people visit Hawaii Volcanoes National Park each year. Visitors can experience the park's volcanoes in several ways. Some people fly over the volcanoes in airplanes or helicopters. This is a safe and popular way to watch Kilauea's lava moving slowly toward the ocean. Visitors can also explore Kilauea's Crater Rim Drive. The crater is the round area that leads down to a volcano. The Crater Rim Drive is 18 kilometers around. Adventure-seeking travelers may wish to climb to the top of the park's other volcano, Mauna Loa. It is considered the world's largest single mountain. The Mauna Loa Trail climbs almost 35 kilometers to the volcano's summit. There is no shade or protection from the strong Hawaiian sun. Most hikers can climb the trail in 2 days. Mauna Loa's summit is almost always cold and often snowy. Hikers can stay in a simple house at the top of the mountain before they begin the trip back down.
The park has shorter hikes as well, including the 2-kilometer Pu'u Petroglyphs Trail. Visitors walk through lava fields filled with petroglyphs. The images document the life and culture of native Hawaiians. The Devastation Trail winds through a part of the park that was destroyed by the 1959 eruption of the Kilauea Iki crater. During the burst, hot ash and huge pieces of volcanic rock called pumice fell on the area. The forested area thick with trees was burned. Today, plant life is returning. The Devastation Trail is near another interesting site within the park, the Thurston Lava Tube. A 20-minute walk through a forest leads to a cave-like tube. The lava tube was discovered in 1913. Today, visitors can walk through it. A path of lights marks the way. But hundreds of years earlier, a fierce river of red lava rushed through the tube. Another reminder of the ever-changing and violent nature of Hawaii's volcanoes. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.